From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan's propane customers are getting ugly surprises when they open their bills. So what's behind the propane shortage?
We had massive amounts of snow, which didn't help the situation because propane is transported via truck.
School districts left figuring out how to make up all those missed snow days.
Right now, the state aid requirements say that you need to make those missed days up as days. You can't simply add minutes to each school day.
And a beloved Grand Rapids record store has found a savior.
It was just another case of if somebody didn't step in, it very well was going to just close and everyone would forget about it.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and thank you so much for joining us on this Wednesday. On our show today, what needs to be done to support Michigan schools? Some believe teachers need to be held accountable for problems in our schools, but are we giving them enough support? And then snow days just aren't so simple for most Michigan school districts. Some are already over the limit of 6 missed days, that the days they can have before they must add days to make up for lost class time. And with a month left of winter, there's still a chance for even more snow days. Later in the hour, we ask what is the best way to make up that lost time. But first, like an unwelcome guest, this winter keeps hanging on, serving up record amounts of snow and bitterly cold temperatures. And then there's a propane shortage. So those in Michigan and throughout the Midwest who rely on propane for their heat have to worry about getting propane, and then when they do, dealing with major price increases. What's behind this shortage, and what does it mean for the Michigan homes and businesses that rely on propane? We're joined by Judy Palnow of the Michigan Public Service Commission. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Cindy.
So what is exactly causing this propane shortage?
Well, the propane shortage is really a perfect storm of various factors that came together really last fall it started. You have a large number of farmers in the Midwest who use propane to dry crops. Interestingly, Michigan farmers tend not to use propane.
Okay.
But, of course, we're involved in a regional market, and so you had a big drawdown of propane for a record crop of corn that came in kind of late in the fall, and it also came in extra wet. And so then to dry it, these farmers in other states rely on propane. So they were using it maybe later than they usually did,
okay,
and they used more of it. And then that was followed immediately by the polar vortex, which, of course, caused everyone, not just farmers, but the 9% of folks in Michigan who heat with propane, to use more than they anticipated. And there was no lag between those two events, so there was little chance to build up supply again. And then, of course, we had massive amounts of snow, which didn't help the situation because propane is transported via truck. And so it took longer for them to get the propane where it's needed. Then with the shortage, trucks from Michigan were driving as far as Texas to get new supply and then back. And of course, that just adds to the price and the time involved. And then there have just been a smattering of other occurrences that have disrupted supply, everything from a rail issue in Canada to some pipeline issues. There was a situation in the Upper Peninsula where a facility that provides propane actually ran out at a certain point because they receive product via a pipeline from Wisconsin, and the facility in Wisconsin was installing some new pipes. So there was a period there where they were not moving any product to Rapid River in the Upper Peninsula. And they did run out for a few days. And the good news was once those pumps were installed, product became available again, and even was available in Rapid River a full day earlier than expected. So that just made a tight supply even tighter.
So it really is this whole kind of a spider web of things that have happened.
Yes, it's multiple factors. And, of course, the relentless bitter cold temperatures haven't helped.
No.
And so, you know, even though the price has dropped, that is good news. I haven't talked about that, I think, at all since we've been talking about propane the last month or two. The latest numbers show a 5% decrease in prices in Michigan. That's a statewide average, so that won't be the case everywhere, but that's the first time I've reported a decrease. Now, it's still 63% more than this time last year, but it is a decrease from the previous week.
At least it's not going up. I saw somewhere that Michigan customers were paying around $2.46 a gallon for their residential propane 2 months ago. So what are we paying now?
The latest information is that as of today, the statewide average price is $3.45, and that's down from $3.62 a week ago. So that's a 5% decrease, but it's still 63% more than it was a year ago.
And are you getting any complaints about gouging?
Well, the Attorney General's office is set up to handle those complaints, and we understand that they've received quite a few phone calls and emails about what customers are experiencing in their area. The situation in the Upper Peninsula is still more pronounced than it is in the Lower Peninsula, and their prices are also higher, generally speaking. So I think a lot of calls have come from the Upper Peninsula, but we've heard from folks here, even in the Lansing area, who have been concerned, and so we refer those folks to the Attorney General's office. They can go online at michigan.gov/AG and file a complaint there, or they can also call the Attorney General's office. He has a toll-free number, 877-765-8388, and customers can report that. Now, to my knowledge, you know, every complaint is looked at individually, but I don't believe they've actually determined there's been any gouging going on at this point.
I'm talking with Judy Palnow of the Michigan Public Service Commission as we explore what's behind the propane shortage and the rising prices of propane. We'll take the fact that propane dropped 5% in the last week or so, but it's still up 63% from what people were paying a year ago. So I got to ask, what kind of government help is there, Judy, for people who need help paying those heating bills?
Right. Since December, Governor Snyder has signed several executive orders that have put in place waivers for drivers who transport propane in Michigan. And that means they can drive longer and farther than they would normally be allowed to get product where it needs to go. And so the current executive order goes through March 1st. And so that, I believe, is the fourth executive order the governor has issued on that since December. So this is something that they keep an eye on. Good news that has taken place on this is that Michigan will be receiving an additional $7 million for propane for low-income customers. So that's in addition to $7 million already allocated. So that'll be a total of $14 million made available for propane customers.
I also saw that the Department of Natural Resources, but was on the governor's website saying that they're actually going to relax the firewood permits.
Yes, the firewood permits are being offered earlier than normal, and to the extent possible, if folks have a wood stove in addition to propane heating, we are hearing that folks are availing themselves of more wood, and so we encourage folks to get the permit if they need it. And that just helps take pressure off the propane situation.
Judy Palnow, Michigan Public Service Commission. Thanks for talking with us today, Judy.
Thank you.
Well, lots of us have made the rueful observation that it's pretty sad when we think of, 28 as a gift of warm weather from the weather gods. But that's what we've come to in this endless, snowy, icy, cold winter. But indeed, we have a warm-up to celebrate, if that's not overstating things too strongly. Here to tell us more is MLive and FarmerWeather.com meteorologist Mark Torregrossa. Mark, what's up with this warmer weather?
Well, southwesterly flow bringing warmer temperatures in, and it's also what we'll be saying thank you for this warmer temperatures to that will also bring us the rain, snow, freezing rain, and high winds over the next 48 hours.
Oh, good heavens. All right, so who's getting what and where?
Here's what's going to happen. There's a strong storm system that's going to move to Lake Superior, probably as far as the low pressure center of it. Looks like one of the strongest, if not the strongest, we've had so far this winter. What does that mean? It's a wind maker, a big wind maker. By Thursday night and Friday, all of the Lower Peninsula, maybe much of the UP, could have wind gusts to 50 miles an hour.
Delightful.
Delightful. Now, for today, we're good. If you got to travel, I would recommend today, very early tomorrow morning, very early, before the precipitation hits. The precipitation will hit the Lower Peninsula from southwest to northeast. First is snow, then a period of freezing rain, and then it will warm up considerably tomorrow afternoon into the 40s as we have rain, about a half inch to three quarters of an inch of rain in most areas. Now, I've gotten through the warm part of the storm.
Yes.
The cold part of the storm comes in sometime, it looks like Thursday night, when the storm center moves up to Lake Superior. A strong cold front moves across the Lower Peninsula. Winds switch to the west, start to gust to 50 miles an hour, and we'll go from temperatures in the 40s to, by Friday morning, probably down to about 32 to 35-ish in the Lower Peninsula.
Okay.
And by Friday afternoon, probably down into the upper 20s. And by the time we get to the weekend, we're right back down to lows in the single digits and teens and highs in the 20s. Friday is the iffy day. Will the roads blow dry off, as I call it,
yeah,
with the strong winds,
yeah,
or will they freeze up and remain icy?
So if we want to accentuate the positive, I think the best thing we can do is realize spring is a month away, yeah?
Yes, that's a good thing to do. And one thing that I would encourage you to do, I'm going to do it now, get out, clean off the sidewalk of the snow right now while it's mushy and melty and you can move it, because if you've got some ruts from this last snowstorm and you leave it until Thursday night or Friday, it's going to be a real hazardous ankle breaker out there for you.
It's nice that you're a nice guy, Mark. We can't hate you. You're a nice guy. And we know you don't make the weather. You just bring us the bad news.
I feel like I'm going to have to join that witness protection program where I have to move to Nebraska and change my name if this weather doesn't change soon.
Well, I just know the first day you tell us that we're going to break 60, we will all love you. The heavens will open and the angels will sing.
I'm watching for it. I can't say it yet, though.
Meteorologist Mark Torregrossa with MLive and FarmerWeather.com. Thanks so much, Mark. Well, not really.
You're welcome. Really.
You got to accentuate the positive. Still to come, if you love old vinyl records like this one, get this. There are well over 30,000 of them at Dodd's Record Store in Grand Rapids. And although you might not be able to buy one there, you might be able to rent one. That story in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, Detroit has a lot of vacancies. We knew that, but we didn't know exactly how many vacancies. Well, that's until this week when a project called the Motor City Mapping Project will have counted exactly how many abandoned properties there are in Detroit. The project's been using smartphone apps to take pictures of abandoned buildings and then log them in a mapping database. The technology was created by Loveland Technologies. They've been delivering information to the public about Detroit's land and buildings for years. Before they got involved in the Motor City Mapping Project, they launched a website called Why Don't We Own This? Joining us is Alex Alsop, who's the Chief Products Officer for Loveland Technologies, which runs the site. Hello, Alex.
Hello, thank you.
What is whydon'twe.com?
Why Don't We Own This is a website that presents information on Detroit and Wayne County properties to the public. Everything from ownership and assessment information to information on the tax status of properties in Detroit to information on the fast approaching foreclosure auction this year and for every year since the foreclosure auction went online.
So who is it aimed at? Who uses the site?
You know, I think it's aimed at really anybody who's interested in learning about property in Detroit and certainly Detroit property owners, homeowners who may feel like the information around property ownership is opaque or difficult to access or difficult to understand. Certainly in the foreclosure auction, you know, this is something that affects 40,000 properties a year, and we try to present as much information not just on properties as they go up for auction, but year-round to connect people with resources to help them understand how they can avoid foreclosure. There are really a lot of resources available for people who are facing tax foreclosure in Detroit, and we try to make those more apparent and more accessible.
So the idea is, you found that sometimes people really don't understand where their house is in the foreclosure process.
Yes, that does happen. You know, it affects a lot of people. You know, most of the traditionally the way that you're informed of tax foreclosure is with a yellow baggie that's tacked to your front door, and contains, you know, some legalese and explanation on what the situation is you're facing. And I think, you know, sometimes people are intimidated by that, or they don't get the message, or they don't quite understand how to address it. So we're trying to provide tools to people in the community who are affected, and also those who want to step up and help their neighbors understand what's going on, and provide information that can help people navigate this maze.
Where did the idea come from, Alex, to say let's try to make an interactive map where you could click on and see the status of houses?
Sure. This came out of I think it was the last year that the foreclosure auction was done in person, which used to be a big to-do. Everybody had to go downtown, and you had to stand there and wait for, you know, your property to be read from the Bible of foreclosure auction properties, and stand there and bid on it. And one of the founders of Loveland, Jerry Paffendorf, had gone down there and bid on a couple of properties in the auction and thought, wow, this is just a crazy experience and a crazy system. So the year after that, the auction process moved from in person to online, and it was run by a website called Bid for Assets. So when the auction went online, I think it was 2011, what Loveland did was go to Bid for Assets, which presented very little information on these properties. Typically, when municipalities auction off properties or assets in a foreclosure auction, they're very concerned about information that they present being wrong and being liable for that inaccuracy, so they present as little information as possible.
Gotcha.
So Loveland went online and took all of the data off of the Bid for Assets site, just sort of pulled it onto our system, and then put it on a map, and gave people tools to communicate around the properties that were going into the foreclosure auction, and just tried to create an ecosystem of more data and resources to help people understand what's going on. So initially it was just assessment information, ownership information, and all of the properties going into the tax foreclosure auction, but it's developed from that into really a year-round process of keeping up on what's going on with Detroit property.
That has to be very exhaustive, trying to stay ahead of that. We're talking about a lot of properties over a big area. How do you do it?
I guess we just do our best. Since 2011, you know, we've started to, I think we've gotten more cooperation, and we've developed some good relationships in the city and the county. So we're able to present information on certainly on foreclosure in a much more proactive way than we were initially, where we were just reacting to what went online and what was in the auction. So now we can present information, you know, months in advance, show people what properties are at risk of foreclosure, and then keep updates as the auction approaches, showing what properties have been removed, what properties are making payments towards payment plans to keep themselves out of the auction, and just try to make it a much more year-round process.
Alex, how do you feel that this private online database helps the city and helps the residents and the neighborhoods?
Well, it's not private. Our database is public, and I think that's one of the really key things that that we believe, is that, you know, that public information should be made accessible and available to the public. Typically, you know, all of the information that we present is accessible through existing city or county maintained databases, but a lot of these databases are clunky or difficult to access, or you have to pay, you know, some fee to look up what you're trying to see. So what we try to do is make a much more intuitive and responsive platform that presents that information clearly and isn't just a resource for looking at one data point in the context of one property, but really being able to see, well, what's going on around that property? How is the neighborhood trending? What's the future look like for, you know, properties that are at risk of tax foreclosure, not just this year, but two years or 3 years into the future?
I know that the site's, you know, new in a sense over the last couple of years. What are your hopes for this database in ways that it could help the city and residents and their neighborhoods?
That it continues to grow, that we continue to improve the tool. I think that we hope to encourage more openness around data and the possibilities of what open data can do for people, that it makes it easier to invest in properties in Detroit, that it makes it easier to monitor those investments so that people aren't just speculating on land as properties are purchased. Neighbors have a place to say, hey, this is what's going on with this property that somebody bought. That there's just a more transparent and collaborative approach to, you know, what's happening with property in the city.
Alex Alsop of Loveland Technologies, which runs the site whydon'twe.com. Alex, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Certainly. Thank you.
Vinyl Records. The sight and sound of an LP or a 45 single can unleash torrents of sentiment and memories for those of us who grew up dropping that needle onto a shiny record. And if you've grown up just downloading your music digitally, you need to know there is nothing finer than wandering through the aisles of a record store. A record store like Dodd's Records in Grand Rapids, which has been serving music lovers on the west side of the state for some 30 years now. And with a new owner committed to keeping the love of records alive, the future for the venerable Grand Rapids business is looking pretty bright. Joining me is Charles Preston Smith, owner of the Dodd's Record Store in Grand Rapids. Very good to have you with us.
Thank you.
What led you to decide to buy Dodd's Records? This is a venerable business with a long history in the town. How did you become the owner?
Well, throughout history of Grand Rapids, my life, seeing things come and go, driving up and down the street, and all of a sudden realizing that particular place was gone, I was just afraid that could happen. That could happen to this. And it was just another case of, if somebody didn't step in, it very well was going to just close and everyone would forget about it. It's kind of a work in progress as to what we're going to do to preserve this. But that was my main concern, was that if there's going to be Van Andel and DeVos, there should be Dodds. So.
and Jerry Dodd had many, many years running this store. Tell us a little about him and also what he accumulated in terms of records and CDs and cassettes at Dodd's.
The history that I learned through him and his family and documents were, it originally took him back to when he acquired an existing music store in 1951. So he had been at it himself for that long. So Mr. Dodd's, Jerry, has seen more West Michigan, more Grand Rapids than probably anybody in business today. So he accumulated thousands. I underestimated when I took over, thinking that, you know, maybe I have a collection of 15,000 albums, but I think it's easy closer to double that, as we took to measuring the inventory with a ruler rather than counting them. So
wow.
So we have 30,000 albums, 10,000 CDs, a few thousand cassettes, thousands of 45s, and all of this were things that Jerry accumulated, bought and sold without keeping a written or a computer inventory. He did it all himself and could tell you where anything was at any given time. So I come in and it's, I need to document things and find out what I have. So that's kind of where I started, was let's see what we have. And you know, strangely, I only found 3 8-track tapes in this whole place.
I was going to ask about 8-tracks.
You know, I was kind of disappointed from my own childhood. So I took a trip over Detroit Way and visited my family, and my sister gave me her collection of 100 8-track tapes so I could add to this store. So that was kind of funny, and I'm constantly being criticized by in a fun way by friends and family that I'm adding more to this than I'm taking away. So, yeah, that's just my love for it all.
I'm speaking with Charles Preston Smith. He is the owner of the Dodds Record Store in Grand Rapids, a venerable business that has been serving music lovers for decades. Now, I'm interested, are you buying and selling, or do you want to hang on to this incredible collection and maybe let people borrow things? What do you plan to do with your inventory?
That's what it got, the work in progress. I mean, the original thought was that, you know, I'm going to continue exactly what Jerry was doing. And then as I got deeper into it and the flood of memories and other people coming in and being overwhelmed by, I remember this, I remember that, it made me realize that I was in a position of not wanting to give up very much, which is not very good business sense. So the work in progress, you know, my friends that offered to volunteer to help, they were saying things like, well, you know, this could sell for a lot. And I said, yeah, but imagine it just hanging on the wall there forever. I mean, that's the story behind that is worth more than any dollar. So all of a sudden I created this whole area of about 1,000 records that I knew I'm never going to part with. Well, eventually I'm going to have a way to make money, so we had somebody offer to, I want to rent it for a class reunion. Oh, great idea. You know, then they'll come in, they'll hang out, they'll listen to records from their time and maybe put in an 8-track and remember what it was like to put the little yellow spindle in the 45,
that's
that kind
right.
of thing. And then I don't actually have to part with anything. So I had one person get so frustrated that I let him take the record if he promised to bring it back, and I wouldn't take any money for it. So that was the relationship I built there. The guy came back with another stack of records and said, you know, hey, thanks for letting me borrow this, and here's a few more to add to the collection.
So it almost sounds like you're taking kind of a carefully curated museum, or maybe not so carefully, but lovingly curated museum for the Dodds Record Shop.
I think right now that is the direction that it's going, only because I have to give it a name or people are going to think I'm crazy. Because, okay, it's a museum. It is a museum of memories. And I get nostalgic just even as we discuss it, because that to me is worth more than any dollar amount. And that may be what other people love about taking a record home, is that they can go and experience that on their own. Well, you know, we're just going to have to share that memory at Dodds, is I guess what I'm thinking. So,
Charles, as you've plowed through this incredible decades worth of inventory, what's the most surprising record or the most touching record that you've come across?
I think what's hitting me the most is so many albums from like a local record company or a local record shop or local department store, things that take me back to those memories. I found Diadem Records that was right downtown Grand Rapids, providing for the Christian community and recording. I found you know, local schools, local churches that put things out from the 50s to the 80s, department stores that are closed, Herpelsheimer's, Montgomery Ward's, and other record stores over the past, to see their logo and remember that, oh, 40 years ago I remember going there. So finding those unique things are great. And I think my favorite area of this is the soundtracks, because that is the soundtrack to a movie, and so the flood of memories from all that. And that could be, you know, anything from Back to the Future soundtrack to MAME from the 40s or something. So the wide variety there are my favorites to find. And then there's the one-off where somebody said, do you have any Alice Cooper? And I dig and find his first album.
Wow.
I never would have imagined that.
Oh.
So I would never say I have a favorite, but I am sure getting a lot of favorites. That's happening.
Are you finding younger folk who think that maybe they're missing something when they're downloading digital music, that they're missing some magic?
Well, I guess that's what I found is by bringing together the old with the new, by accident, I put a web camera on a turntable and realized, oh, this is too funny to give up. I have to keep this on here all the time. So for the last 6 months, there's a webcam on a turntable, and you're listening to that record until I change it. So I show this to a young person that comes in, and I say, you know, look what you can pull up on your phone. Well, that gets them sparked, and then they're excited about it. And there are things that I didn't realize that a lot of newer music, more than I realized, is sampled from older things. So I've had some young kids come in and tell me, we're looking for this because we know that it was sampled on this, and I want to learn more about that music. So they're making me dig more and learn some things that I didn't know. So,
Charles Preston Smith, owner of Dodd's Record Store in Grand Rapids. Fun to talk with you, and I look forward to visiting the store when I get to Grand Rapids. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's talk about snow days. As parents cope with having kids at home and underfoot, school administrators have to figure out how to make up for time lost to old man winter. Some districts are already over that limit of 6 missed days that districts are allowed before they must add days to make up for lost class time. And many more are at the limit with another month of winter yet to go. What is the best way to make up lost time? And should local districts be allowed to figure that out for themselves, or should Lansing help make the decision for them? Bridge Magazine contributing writer Ted Roloffs dug into these questions for his story in this week's Bridge. Now, Ted, remind us again exactly what Michigan law spells out. How much instruction has to be offered each school year so districts qualify for state aid?
Well, the bar is set at 170 days, and there's a forgiveness of 6 snow days. So when you drop below that threshold or above the threshold of 6 snow days, you have to start making those days up. And there's districts already. I found one that's at 12. There might be some that are even above that. So that's six days beyond the limit, and they've got to figure out how they're going to deal with that. And right now, the state aid requirements say that you need to make those missed days up as days. Not, you can't simply add minutes to each school day to try to make up that lost time. So that's part of the discussion that we explored in the story.
Yes.
That I wrote, which is, should districts have the flexibility to add minutes to days remaining in this school year so they don't have to add, say, 4 or 5 days in June?
And we've seen, as you write in your piece for Bridge, that Cadillac Republican Representative Phil Potvin has introduced a bill that basically would give districts that option, right, of adding the 30 minutes a day to make up for lost days.
Yep.
Is this being well-received by school districts and superintendents?
Well, it depends. I spoke with several superintendents who are opposed to the idea of adding minutes. They don't feel it really gives you an equivalent educational value. Others kind of think, well, it depends on how you do it. It depends on what sort of quality you attach to adding minutes to days, and they do believe districts should have that flexibility. On a state level, the superintendent of schools has stated his opposition to adding minutes to days instead of adding days at the end of the year, as well as the Board of Education, State Board of Education, passed a resolution a little while ago stating the same thing. So that's where we are. And last year, the legislature did approve the flexibility, giving districts that flexibility to add minutes. And there is a similar resolution that is up for consideration this year. Last year was supposed to be a one-time thing. Well, here we are next year. We're doing the same thing, or it's being proposed that the same thing be done.
I'm wondering what it is that Superintendent Flanagan doesn't like, or that the state's Board of Education does not like about that option, because it's not a mandate, is it? It's just it's one more tool for administrators to use?
No, it would be an option. And this is a kind of a philosophic belief that the educational value of, let's say, if this proposal that's before the legislature mandates it be at least 30 minutes. If you're going to add minutes, it has to be at least 30 minutes per day. If you break that down by class, we're talking roughly 5 minutes a class. Some educators would make the argument that you're not going to really do anything in that 5 extra minutes that you have. And here's the assertion. Let's say you have a snow day on a Thursday and you missed geometry lesson X. That's an entire class period, that lesson.
Yeah.
That's gone. The only way to get that lesson back, they say, is to hold a full day. You can't make up a lesson by you've got an extra 5 minutes. We're going to somehow go back and get that lesson back. That's the argument.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of this comes out of the fact that Michigan used to be 180-day school year. That standard changed, I think it was in 2003. That was kind of in the midst of the deep recession, a lot of financial crisis in districts. So they were given the flexibility to just have a certain number of hours, not a certain defined school year. And what happened was a lot of districts were holding school years that were even below 160 days. So they stepped back in and they said, this isn't good. We need to start heading back toward 180-day school year as a tool for improving learning on a statewide level. So that's also part of this discussion.
And we know that the minimum days in the school year is going up from that 170 to 175 next year, but we're still behind many states. What is it, more than 30 states have that 180-day year?
Exactly.
Mm.
Exactly. So, and you know, that again, it's if you look at some of the nations that have generally led the world in performance in school, many of them have school days that are above 200. So
going to 175 still puts us behind not only the rest of the much of the nation, but much of the world. You raise an interesting piece in another story you did for Bridge, Ted Roloffs. In this whole discussion about snow days, you point out there's another interesting twist when a school district cancels classes, but then, my goodness, we're going to have the basketball game at night or athletic practices during the day. And I would think, shouldn't it be if you can't have class, you shouldn't be having basketball?
Well, some would say yes. Some would say no. I mean, I can recall, and I think this is a valid argument. Let's say we've got storm blowing in on a Thursday night, overnight, 3 a.m. It's kind of reaching a peak. The roads are really bad. Mm-hmm. School's called off for Friday. By 1 p.m., the storm has moved out. Let's say it's moved out by 5 a.m. It's pretty much gone. The roads are all cleaned up. By 1 o'clock, the sun is shining. And some would say, well, let's have the basketball game. Let's have the school play, whatever other activities are there. Now, again, this is done by districts.
Sure.
Some districts have a blanket policy. No school, no activities, period. Other districts take it event by event. They kind of assemble the weather team, make the decision typically by early in the afternoon whether they're going to have evening activities. And there's been a lot of that this winter because there were so many occasions where it was not only snow, but there were a lot of wind chill cancellations, and it's a tricky decision.
Yeah, you really do take us into what goes into that decision, and it's quite clear it is not made lightly. I kind of wonder, as we try to wrestle with how do we make up these lost days, is there any discussion happening anywhere in Michigan about starting school before Labor Day again? I know we is kind of a with pressure from the travel industry, they pushed it back to after Labor Day. My kids always started the third week of August and the world didn't end. Or what about trimming back the winter break days? They come right after Christmas break or MLK and President's Days?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of options. The districts are starting to look at a lot of scheduled off days for teacher activities and that sort of thing, where, okay, this was supposed to be a day off, but now we're gonna hold school as a way to not put so much of the burden at the end of the year. And that's, again, being done district by district, case by case. A lot of times there has to be a negotiated agreement between the district and the teachers union as to how they're going to schedule this. But on it goes, and I'm sure it's going to be, especially with another 4 weeks of winter,
there's
going to be a lot more of that going on.
Ted Roloffs, contributing writer to Bridge Magazine. Thanks for taking us inside that decision-making process of to call a snow day or not to call a snow day.
Absolutely.
As Michigan moves into new uncharted waters in terms of testing and evaluating those who hope to become teachers, There are many views on whether this testing and evaluation is fair, it's helpful, and an accurate measurement of how students, teachers, and schools are doing. One of the voices questioning the direction Michigan is going is that of my next guest. Longtime teacher Mitch Robinson is an associate professor and chair of music education at Michigan State University. His research is focused on education policy. Mitch, welcome to Stateside. It's very good to have you with us.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
You recently wrote a column, and in it you took on Thomas Friedman for an op-ed piece that he wrote in the New York Times on January 18th. What did Friedman say in that piece that you felt was so wrong?
Well, first of all, I'm not trying to take on anybody. Certainly Mr. Friedman's not worried about what I'm saying about this, but I think it's become very easy and kind of trendy to demonize teachers and to put teachers as the sole reasons for any problems in the schools. And the fact is that I think the vast majority of our public schools are in great shape. Most people are really happy with the schools. In fact, almost all people really happy with their schools. It's kind of a NIMBY problem. People tend to be upset about schools in other places. But I think a lot of that is because we don't really have good, accurate information. And I think, you know, there's a political climate that doesn't really make it very attractive to stand up for public schools right now.
And amidst all the talk that, that schools are America's schools are failing, you don't see that?
No. I think the current climate talks about evidence-based reform, and what's kind of surprising to me is that there's really not any evidence that the schools are failing. When you look at the data about how American schools are faring, for example, compared to schools in other countries, and we usually hear about Finland and Taiwan, when you correct that data for socioeconomic status, American public schools are doing as well or better than schools in any country in the world. But that's not a very attractive story to sell if you're trying to, you know, ruin teachers' unions and if you're trying to hurt teachers. So that's kind of the dominant political narrative right now, and I think Mr. Friedman has bought that line uncritically, and I think it's time that we tell the real story about how good the schools are, and I just felt the need to do that.
And in that op-ed piece, Friedman spent a lot of time talking about the messages sent out by Education Secretary Arne Duncan. What's your perspective on what Secretary Duncan is saying about our education?
Well, you know, I'm disappointed in Arne Duncan's leadership in that office. I think he's looking in the wrong places for the right solutions. What teachers need right now is not to be castigated. It's not to be demonized, and it's not to be demoralized. As someone who works to prepare new teachers for the schools, it does make our job pretty difficult when people like Mr. Duncan and Michelle Rhee and Wendy Kopp are not making teaching a very attractive profession. So I think they're looking in the wrong places. Again, when we correct the data for socioeconomic status, American schools and American teachers are as good as they are anywhere in the world, and I think Mr. Duncan needs to know that. I also think we need to start valuing the expertise that we do have in education. With all due respect to Mr. Duncan, I'm sure he's a brilliant man. He's not a teacher, and it's time that we have a teacher or someone who's worked in education for their whole life in that office.
You write that this corporate reform agenda is a set of solutions in search of a problem. What did
right.
you mean by that?
Well, I think this is a manufactured crisis. There's, we saw this going back as far as No Child Left Behind, that there was a statement made at one point that if some other country had done to America's schools what we've allowed to happen, that would be an act of war. That's pretty inflamed rhetoric. People that I know that have been working in the schools for a long time realize that the crisis is real now, but it's one that's been created in order to capitalize on kind of a set of manufactured crises. The fact is that teacher education programs are in really strong shape. We get terrific students at Michigan State, and I'm sure we do at a lot of schools across the country. Teachers are taking their jobs very seriously in spite of not having a lot of support, sometimes from their own cultures and societies. And so I think what we need to do is return to valuing what teachers do for our communities and not setting them up as the single problem in what's happening in the schools.
But in response to that sense that America as a nation is falling behind other countries, let's say Japan, in the kinds of classes kids are taking and the kind of caliber of the instruction, what do you say
right.
to that?
Well, first of all, I'd like them to show us the evidence of that. I teach at a university where there is a huge number of students coming here from other countries. If we're falling so far behind, why aren't we sending our students there? Students certainly have the capabilities to go other places. I think that's a solution in search of a problem. People that work in our schools and people that are receiving our students are not worried about the quality of education. I think we're manufacturing a crisis, and I'm afraid that there are some political goals, and they're not really educational goals.
What goals, what political goals do you fear?
Well, what worries me is when I see, in New York City, for example, there's a phenomenon called co-locating of schools. That's where charter schools and other private schools are given the right to set up shop inside the walls of a public school in New York City. They pay no rent. They pay no utilities. And they, you know, that just seems like squatting to me. So that's not really a fair and equal playing ground. We also see a lot of private schools, charter schools, and academies that if a child has special needs, they either don't admit that child or they expel that child when that child isn't contributing to higher test scores. The research on charters in specific shows that they're not doing better than average normal public schools and in many cases are doing worse. And yet in Michigan, we've removed the cap on charter schools with no research or evidence that points to that as a legitimate solution to improve student learning.
Mitch, you write that we are not asking the right questions. What questions do you believe we should be asking?
Well, I went on a little bit of a rant at the end of that column with all those questions. And I mean, to me, those are the questions that we're not asking because I think the people that are asking the questions don't want to hear those answers.
Spell those out
for us. I want to know why we're not supporting teachers in the schools where they are right now. I want to know why we're obsessed with single measures like standardized tests to determine whether students are learning and whether prospective teachers are ready for the classroom. We already know how to tell how teachers are doing in the classroom. What I'm convinced of is that we don't have the stomach or the political courage to actually spend the money and the time to do that kind of comprehensive evaluation. The fact of the matter is that what we do is we change the target every time we get an answer we don't like.
You also raise the issues of child poverty and food insecurity. That mm-hmm. we should be asking questions that we're not.
I think that's true. I think, you know, if again, when we correct all of the data that gets thrown about in the media about how America's falling behind, when we correct that for socioeconomic status, we see that the issues in education are really the issues in society and in unemployment and in the economy. The problems are more endemic and they're more systemic. And I think there are problems with poverty and with child hunger, but I don't think we're going to fix those by getting rid of some teacher in some classroom somewhere. Those are deeper problems, and they deserve our attention in a deep way.
Mitch Robinson is an associate professor and chair of music education at Michigan State University, and his column appeared in Okemos Parents for Schools on their website. Mitch, thank you so much for talking with us and sharing your insights.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today is Tony Brown. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hadlesy, Katie Suhak, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Worniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.